This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Thursday, September 28th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. The populist wing of the Republican Party has begun a new offensive in Washington. Steve Bannon talked about this in an interview with Charlie Rose a few weeks ago.
The Republicans are trying to nullify the election?
Yes.
Who?
I think Mitch McConnell and to a degree Paul Ryan. And I've had a very good relationship with Paul Ryan, but I think that their leadership is trying to nullify the election.
To what end? To get their former colleague as president?
I think they're trying to nullify this to get their own program instituted first, and then we'll see what happens later. But no, they do not want Donald Trump's populist, economic, nationalist agenda to be implemented. It's very obvious. It's obvious as night follows day.
Brian Lissa joins me to discuss what Bannon's war on the establishment means for the Trump agenda, the Republican Party, and Democrats. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, Dorothy.
So as I recall, Bannon spent most of that interview attacking Republicans, not Democrats. I think he referred to some congressional Democrats as smart guys. And then in another interview with Sean Hannity, he said that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell was guilty of economic war crimes. So first of all, what does he mean by economic war crimes, and what is he up to?
When he was in the White House, he viewed his enemies in concentric circles. They started with the economic advisors around Trump, like Gary Cohn, the top economic advisor, and then they radiated out to Republicans on the Hill, the Republican leadership, Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell, and then what he liked to call the opposition party, the media. And only in the fourth or fifth circle were the actual Democrats in Congress, who he viewed as kind of a non-entity because they're in the minority. But now that he's outside the White House, he's really decided that the main obstacle in the way of Trumpism, or what he believes should represent Trumpism, are so-called establishment Republicans. And he has decided to use his platform at Breitbart.com to wage war against McConnell and Paul Ryan and enter into as many primaries as Breitbart can afford to get into on the side of the more Trump-like populist nationalist candidates and try and transform Congress the way that the White House has been transformed. Because I think he realized once he got in there that if he wanted to institute Trump's agenda or his vision of Trump's agenda, he just didn't have a populist wing as part of the Republican Congress. It just didn't exist.
I want you to take us back a little bit so we can put this in perspective. When the Tea Party took over the House in 2010 in the midterm elections, they came in with a similar message. As you were just saying, Paul Ryan, who's a leader of the Tea Party, is now, you know, not nearly extreme enough. So how does someone like Ryan become an enemy of Trump's base?
So much of these movements are defined by what they're against rather than what they're for. And there obviously is overlap between the Tea Party that formed in 2009 and 10 and the populist grassroots that propelled Trump. But there are differences between the policies that the two ideological camps would promote. Paul Ryan, who obviously wouldn't be speaker without the Tea Party insurgency, is much more of a small government, libertarian-minded conservative, someone whose probably number one policy goal is to reduce the size of government and reduce taxes. Bannon never really saw things like that. He has never liked the libertarians, has never liked the small government conservatives. And then just moreover, he'll get behind candidates who are anti-establishment for the sake of being anti-establishment, like Roy Moore in Alabama.
This morning, the newspapers are full of stories about the ramifications of this primary runoff election in Alabama for 2018, for the future of the Republican Party, the future of the Democratic Party.
Yes. And this was basically a proxy fight between the establishment Republicans and the insurgents. Very interestingly, Trump lined up with the establishment. Mitch McConnell and others convinced him to endorse the incumbent senator, Luther Strange, and he was being challenged by this extremely right-wing Christian fundamentalist named Roy Moore, who, if you follow politics closely, has been making headlines for decades Roy Moore, when he was on the Alabama Supreme Court, refused an order to take down a statue of the Ten Commandments. Extremely anti-gay marriage, has talked about how homosexuals should be punished. But it just way out of even the Republican mainstream, even in the era of Trump. But what's fascinating is the lessons learned from the Republican establishment over this race. And there was a very revealing memo written by an ally of McConnell right before the election was happening. This basically said that the Republican Party has been reshaped, or at least for Republican primary voters, it has been reshaped in the image of Trump. Trump is the only popular figure among Republican primary voters, and that hatred for Obama has been replaced by hatred for Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan.
It's just astonishing.
Just a fascinating development. And that's very much the attitude that Steve Bannon had. Now, I don't want to give Bannon too much credit for this race, because it looked like Moore was going to win no matter what. And Bannon, I think very strategically jumped on this race, knowing that Moore was going to win, and if he did win, Bannon would get a little bit of credit.
Well, and he's now riding high. Tell us about the other far-right primary challengers he's backing. He's taking this strategy forward in other races.
Yeah, there are a couple of others that in the same memo talks about them. In Arizona and Nevada, where incumbent Republicans are worried about challenges from the right. I thought one of the fascinating things, not to harp too much on this memo, but it was quite revealing. It went through a little bit of history. And if you remember in 2010 and 2012, Republicans encountered a very similar problem of Tea Party insurgents and, what they considered poor, undisciplined candidates winning primaries against mainstream establishment Republicans. In general, in 2010 and 12, those primary winners, the subpar candidates, went on to lose the general election to Democrats. And Republicans believed that they would have won the Senate by 2012 if they had snuffed out those insurgencies. 2014 to 2016, they believed that they had sort of picked the lock on how to defeat those candidates. And they obviously took back the Senate in 2014, did okay in 2016. And there was this belief that they had sort of tamed the spirits in the party. As this memo points out, they've got to recalibrate, and that Moore suggests that whatever they were doing right in 14 and 16 didn't work, and that the new phenomenon in the party is Trump versus McConnell and the congressional leadership.
So the fear in Congress is that the center is collapsing, and so Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee is retiring. He was going to be facing a well-funded right-wing primary challenger. So is Representative Charlie Dent from Pennsylvania, who said that the most basic tasks of governing have become too difficult. John McCain has brain cancer. Susan Collins, who played a defining role in defeating Trump care, is likely to run for governor.
Look, the center hasn't really existed in Congress for a while, but the longer a senator has been around, some of the rough edges of even the most vocal conservatives sort of get sanded off over years. I remember John Cornyn from Texas, who's now the number two in the Senate. He was considered sort of the Ted Cruz of his day, and now he's considered an establishment moderate.
And Paul Ryan in the House.
Exactly. One of the original insurgents in the House who now is just hated. So that's sort of the cycle of life in politics once you're in Washington too long. But, Roy Moore makes Ted Cruz look like Bob Dole.
What about Democrats? How many of their resources do you think they'll put into their support for the Democratic candidate in the December special election?
They've been burned with some of these special elections in the past recently, right? In Georgia, they lost a big one. Originally, they had no chance of winning the race, then dumped a ton of money in, but still came up short. In general, what we've seen from the special election so far this year is an enormous amount of money and enthusiasm on the Democratic side that exceeds the Republican side. So, I think that they'll probably take a really good look at Alabama and see if they can actually beat this guy. But going forward, the Democrats are very united right now on policy, and sometimes that happens when you're in the opposition. But the Republicans, despite being a more homogenous party in a lot of ways, is just deeply divided.
And Trump is exploiting that. Far from trying to bring the party together, now he still, as far as I can tell, is with Chuck and Nancy rather than with his own.
Well, the bizarre thing about all this is that Trump of course, he endorsed Luther Strange, the McConnell candidate. But if you listen to him carefully at his rally in Alabama, it was a lukewarm endorsement, and he even blurted out loud, as Trump often does. In the middle of endorsing Luther Strange, he said, "Well, I may be making a mistake here."
Well, and then he immediately pretended it had never happened.
And did something I cannot remember him ever doing before. He actually deleted tweets of his endorsement of Strange. I mean, there are some crazy Trump tweets that still exist on Twitter that he's never cared about deleting, including, for example, that famous one about Ted Cruz's wife. But for some reason, he was so embarrassed by his endorsement of Strange that he deleted them.
The next big agenda item for Congress is tax reform. And, you know, Mitch McConnell isn't exactly the kind of guy who panics, at least publicly, but this is a really important moment for him.
Absolutely. One of the lessons that Republicans have taken from that Alabama race is that their failure to repeal Obamacare is absolutely poison, and that among Trump's strongest supporters, one, they blame congressional leadership, not Trump, but two, they see it as a major, major broken promise and violation. It's one of the reasons McConnell and Ryan are suffering so much at the hands of their own voters. So I think they have a choice here. You know, I think the Ryan view is healthcare is over, done with. We're not going to accomplish that. So move on to tax reform, at least do something that we have a chance at passing.
Let's be clear that this isn't tax reform. This is tax cuts.
I know. I just violated the
old
rule of a piece I just posted.
tell us about that.
Well, you know, tax reform has a specific meaning in the context of these debates, you know, and the tax reform is a plan that clears out all the weeds in the tax code so that you can lower rates overall. And the key to that is you make it revenue neutral. That is, you don't change the amount of taxes coming in, but you get rid of a lot of the wasteful deductions and tax expenditures and loopholes and all the stuff that's sort of built up over time. So it's a combination of, frankly, of tax increases and tax decreases. That's the way that tax reform has always been defined. That's the way that Paul Ryan defined it in his plan that he put forward last year and in speeches earlier this year. And that just became too hard. They couldn't come up with the stuff to clear away. To do that, you have to take on certain special interests. And so now they're edging much, much closer to just a traditional across-the-board tax cut, perhaps touching some of the deductions. But it's really a tax cut plan, not a tax reform plan in the traditional sense.
So I noticed this morning some pundits are saying that if McConnell and Ryan fail again with tax cuts, it is possible that one or both houses could lose their majorities?
You know, if you think through the possibilities of how 2017 could end legislatively, I think the safest bet is just nothing happens. They have to have a debt ceiling pass, and they have to have the funding bills passed so the government doesn't shut down. So you have to assume that that happens. That might happen with a lot of brinksmanship and chaos and maybe a government shutdown. That's sort of the bare minimum. The next possibility is the big, ambitious stuff, Obamacare repeal, that's already failed, and then tax reform, which has all sorts of complexities and parliamentary obstacles in the way, just as difficult as Obamacare repeal, if not more so. Perhaps that doesn't happen. And then Trump may be left with, well, I need to do something. Maybe I'll just stick with that deal I made with Chuck Schumer, and I'll pass the legislative fix for DACA.
Well, that's not going to exactly please his base.
Not at all. And then the other bipartisan thing that is going on beneath the surface is a fix to Obamacare that would just help fix some of the problems of the exchanges. So one possibility is that both so-called tax reform and Obamacare repeal dies, but that a bipartisan deal on immigration and Obamacare actually passes. That would be quite a shocking way for the Republicans to end the year. They would basically be cementing Obamacare into place and cementing his DACA executive order into place, only it's better than an executive order because it would have a legislative fix. That would send the Republicans into 2018 in very, very poor shape. And the most optimistic scenario for the Republicans is now that they pass some version of tax cuts and they escape the December deadlines without a government shutdown. and that they at least next year can go into the election year bragging that they cut everyone's taxes. Because you think about it, if a Republican Party with unified control in Washington can't cut taxes, I mean, what can it do?
Thanks so much, Ryan.
Thanks, Dorothy.
Ryan Liz is a staff writer and an on-air contributor for CNN. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review The Political Scene on Apple Podcasts. This podcast is produced by Alex Barron for newyorker.com with help from Hannah Wilentz. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.